Chapter 22. Cavendish was superbly intoxicated. The Englishman had shoved his raven's beak onto the top of his head to allow his rosebud mouth unimpeded access to his wine goblet. He had been gurgling wine throughout the medieval-style dinner, washing down the exotic game dishes, everything from larks to boars, like a human garbage disposal. Austin picked at his food to be polite, took an occasional sip of wine, and advised Skye to do the same. They would need clear heads if his instincts were on the mark. As soon as the dessert dishes were removed, Cavendish staggered to his feet and tapped the side of his water glass with a spoon. All eyes turned in his direction. He raised his goblet. "I would like to offer a toast to our host and hostess." "Hear, hear," his fellow guests replied in boozy acknowledgement, lifting their drinks as well. Encouraged by the response, Cavendish smiled. "As many of you know, the Fauchard and the Cavendish families go back centuries. We all know how the Fauchard, borrowed the Cavendish process for forging steel on a mass basis, thus assuring their own rise while my people faded into the sunset." "The fortunes of war," said the ape from the murders in the Rue Morgue. "I'll drink to that." Cavendish took a swig from his goblet. "Unfortunately, or fortunately, given the tendency of Fauchards to meet fatal accidents, we never married into their family." "The fortunes of love," said the woman draped in bells. The guests around the table roared their drunken approval. Cavendish waited for the laughter to die down, then said, "I doubt if the word love was ever uttered in this household. But anyone can love. How many families can boast that they single-handedly started the war to end all wars?" A heavy silence descended on the table. The guests glanced furtively at Madame Fauchard, who had been sitting at the head of the table with her son seated to her right. She maintained the waxen smile she had held throughout the oration, but her eyes radiated the same heat Austin had seen when Skye mentioned her mortality. "Monsieur Cavendish is most flattering, but he exaggerates the influence of the Fauchard family," she said in a cool voice. "There were many causes for the Great War. Greed, stupidity, and arrogance, to name a few. Every family in this room joined the jingoistic pack in urging on the war that made us all fortunes." Cavendish would not be discouraged. "Take credit where credit is due, my dear Racine. It is true that we arms people owned the newspapers and bribed the politicians who howled for war. But it was the Fauchard family, in its infinite wisdom, that paid to have the Grand Duke Ferdinand assassinated, thus plunging the world into a bloody brawl. We all know the rumors that Jules Fauchard bolted the pack, thus ensuring his untimely departure from the earth." "Monsieur Cavendish," Madame Fauchard said, her voice a warning growl. But the Englishman was on a roll. "But what many don't know," he said, "is that the Fauchards also bankrolled a certain Austrian corporal throughout his political rise and encouraged members of the Japanese Imperial Army to take on the United States." He paused to take a drink. "That turned out to be more than you bargained for, and things got a bit out of your control, what with your slave factories bombed to dust. But as someone said a moment ago, the fortunes of war." The chamber was gripped by an almost unbearable tension. Madame Fauchard had removed her plague mask, and the loathing etched in her face was even more terrible than the Red Death. Austin had no doubt that if Racine had been capable of telekinesis, the weapons would have jumped off the walls and hacked Cavendish to bits. One of the guests broke the heavy silence. "Cavendish, you've said enough. Sit down." For the first time, Cavendish became aware of Madame Fauchard's withering stare. The Englishman's brain had caught up with his mouth, and he knew he had gone too far. His foolish grin vanished, and he wilted like a flower under the heat of a sun lamp. He sat down ponderously, more sober than when he had stood only moments before. Madame Fauchard rose like a cobra uncoiling and raised her glass. Merci. Now I will offer a toast to the great, late House of Cavendish. The Englishman's ruddy complexion turned the color of paste. He mumbled his thanks and said, "You must excuse me. I don't feel well. Touch of the indigestion, I fear." Rising from his chair, he made his way toward the exit and disappeared through the doorway. Madame Fauchard glanced at her son. "Please see to our guest. We wouldn't want him to fall in the moat." The light-hearted comment seemed to break the tension, and conversation resumed as if the previous few minutes had never happened. Austin was less sanguine. As he watched Cavendish leave the room, he thought the Englishman had signed his own death warrant. "What's going on?" Skye said. "The Fauchards don't take well to having their dirty laundry hung out in public, especially when strangers are present." Austin watched Madame Fauchard lean over to say something to her son. Emil smiled and rose from the table. He collected Marcel, and together they left the armory. After dinner, brandy was being served when Emil returned about 10 minutes later, without Marcel. He gazed directly at Austin and Skye as he whispered in his mother's ear. Madame Fauchard nodded her head, her face impassive. The move was subtle, but Austin didn't miss the implication. His name and Skye's had just been added to the Cavendish death warrant. Several minutes later, Marcel returned from his mission. Emil saw that he was back, then stood and clapped his hands. "Ladies and gentlemen of the Mask of the Red Death, Prince Prospero has prepared a memorable entertainment to cap off the evening's festivities." He signaled a servant who lit a torch from the flames of a brazier and handed it to Emil. With great ceremony, Emil produced a large skeleton key from the folds of his tunic and led the way along the nave, crossing the transept to the rear of the armory. He paused to insert the key in a low wooden door carved with skulls and human bones. As he opened the door, his torch flared and sputtered in the cool, musty air that flowed through the portal. "Follow me, if you dare," Emil said with a smirking leer on his face, and then he ducked under the jamb. Laughing giddily, the guests paused, then with wine goblets in hand, they filed after Emil like the children of Hamelin following the Pied Piper. Austin put his hand on Skye's arm and kept her from going with the others. "Make believe you're drunk," Austin said.
"I wish I were drunk," Skye said. "Merde, here comes the dragon lady."
Madame Fauchard glided over and said, "The Red Death must take its leave, Monsieur Austin. Sorry we couldn't get to know each other better." "I am too. That was an interesting toast Sir Cavendish gave," he said, slurring his words. "Great families are often the subject of malicious gossip." She turned to Skye. "The masquerade is at an end. I believe you have a relic that belongs to my family."
"What are you talking about?"
"Don't toy with me. I know you have the helmet."
"Then it was you who sent that awful man."
"Sebastian?" "No, he is my son's lapdog. If it's any consolation to you, he will be eliminated as a result of his failures."
"Never mind.
We will persuade you to tell us where our property is.
As for you, Monsieur Austin, I must bid you farewell."
"Until we meet again," Austin said, swaying slightly. She gazed at him with a look approaching sadness.
"Yes, until we meet again."
Escorted by an entourage of servants, Madame Fauchard headed for the exit. Marcel had been standing nearby. Now he came over and curled his lip in his movie gangster's smile. "Monsieur Emil would be heartbroken if you missed the entertainment he has prepared for you." "Wouldn't miss it for the world," Austin said, deliberately slurring his words. Marcel lit another torch and gestured toward the door. Austin and Skye caught up with the tail end of the raucous crowd. Marcel took up the rear to make sure they didn't stray. The procession descended a short stone staircase to a passageway about 6 feet wide. As the guests plunged deeper into the bowels of the chateau, the laughter began to ebb. The merriment died completely, along with conversation, when the guests entered a section of tunnel lined with eye-level stone shelves that overflowed with human bones. Emil stopped in front of a shelf, picked out a skull at random, and held it above his head where it grinned down at the guests, as if amused by their clever costumes. "Welcome to the catacombs of Chateau Fauchard," Emil proclaimed with the cheerfulness of a Disney World tour guide. "Meet one of my ancestors. Pardon if he is a bit reserved. He doesn't get many visitors." He tossed the skull back into a recess where it started a small avalanche of femurs, ribs, and clavicles. Then he forged ahead, exhorting the guests to hurry or they would miss the show. The tunnel entered a series of large, barred rooms that Emil explained were the dungeons and torture chambers. Braziers had been set up in each room so their flickering light was filtered through stained glass screens of different colors. The strange colored light illuminated the wax faces of figures that looked so lifelike that no one would have been surprised if they had moved. In one chamber, a great ape was stuffing a woman up a chimney. In another, a man was digging himself out of a grave. Every room had a scene from a Poe story. Emil drifted back to Austin. The torchlight gave his mordant features a satanic cast that fit in with the surroundings. "Well, Monsieur Austin, what do you think of my little show so far?"
"Haven't had so much fun since I went to Madame Tussaud's wax museum."
"You flatter me.
Bravo.
The best is yet to come."
Emil kept going until he came to a chamber whose crimson light made all within its special radiance look like victims of the Red Death. In the floor of the room was a circular pit. A razor-sharp pendulum was swinging above a wooden framework. Strapped down on the framework, with rats crawling over his chest, was a large black bird. It was the scene from The Pit and the Pendulum, where the victim is being tortured by the Spanish Inquisition. Only in this instance, the victim was Cavendish, who was tied down and gagged on the table.
"You will notice some differences in this scene," Emil said. "The rats you see scurrying around the dungeon are real.
And so is the victim.
Mr. Cavendish is a good sport, as the English would say, and he has gracefully agreed to participate for our amusement."
As Emil led the guests in a polite applause, Cavendish struggled against the bonds that held him. The pendulum swung lower until it was only inches from the heaving chest.
"He's going to be killed," a woman screamed.
"Sliced and diced," Emil said with an incongruous cheeriness. He lowered his voice to a stage whisper.
"Lord Cavendish is a ham at heart, I fear. Don't worry, my friends. The blade is made of wood. We wouldn't want our guests to go to pieces. But if it worries you..."
He snapped his fingers and the swinging pendulum slowed to a stop. Cavendish gave a violent convulsion and lay still. Emil led the guests into the last dungeon. Although there was no scene set up in the chamber, in some ways it was the most frightening of all. The walls were covered in black velvet that stole what light escaped through the opaque black screen. The atmosphere was the most oppressive. There was a collective sigh of relief when Emil told his guests to follow a passageway which would lead from the dungeon. When Austin and Skye went to follow, he barred their way. Austin stumbled drunkenly and whipped his cap off in a grand sweep.
"After you, Gaston."
Emil had shed his foppish Prospero act, and now his voice was businesslike and as hard-edged as cold steel.
"While Marcel leads our guests out of the catacombs, I have something special to show you and the young lady," he said, lifting a fold of black velvet draped against a wall.
Behind the cloth was a cleft in the stones about 2 feet wide. Austin blinked.
"What's going on? Is this part of the show?"
"Yes," Emil said with a hard smile. "This is part of the show."
He produced a pistol. Austin looked at the gun and gave a soggy laugh.
"Hell of a show," he said, shaking his head so the bells jangled.
He stepped through the opening, with Skye, then Emil behind her. They descended 2 more sets of stairs. The temperature dropped and the air became swamp-like.
Water glistened on the walls and dripped down on their heads. They continued down until Emil finally ordered them to stop in front of a recess about 5 feet wide and 4 feet deep. He thrust the torch into a sconce and pulled the cloth off a pile of bricks. A trowel and a bucket of mortar sat on the floor next to the bricks. From a niche, he extracted a wine bottle whose dark green glass was covered with dust and cobwebs. The bottle was stopped up with a cork, which Emil removed with his teeth. He handed the bottle to Austin. "Drink, Monsieur Austin." Austin stared at the bottle.
"Maybe we should let it breathe for a while."
"It has had centuries to breathe," Fauchard said. He gestured with his gun. "Drink." Austin grinned foolishly as if he thought the gun was a toy and put the bottle to his mouth. Some of the wine dribbled down his chin and he wiped it away. He offered the bottle to Fauchard, who said, "No, thank you. I prefer to remain conscious."
"Huh?"
"You have caused us a great deal of trouble," Emil said. "My mother said to dispose of you in the most fitting way I could think of. A good son always does what his mother tells him to. Sebastian, say hello again to Ms. Boucher." A figure stepped from the shadows and the torchlight illuminated the pale features of the man Austin had dubbed the Doughboy. His right arm was in a sling.
"I believe you've met Sebastian," Emil said. "He has a gift for you, mademoiselle."
Sebastian threw a crossbow bolt at Skye's feet. "This is yours."
"What's going on?" Austin said. "Your wine contained a paralytic substance," Emil said. "Within moments, you will be unable to move, but all your other senses will function fine, and you will know what is happening to you."
He produced a pair of manacles from under his cloak and dangled them in front of Austin's face.
"Maybe if you say, 'For the love of God, Montresor,' I'll let you go."
"You bastard," Austin said. He leaned against the wall with his hand as if the strength were ebbing from his legs, but his eyes were fixed on the crossbow bolt a few feet away. Skye had gasped in fright when she first saw Sebastian. Now, seeing Austin's plight, she lunged for Fauchard's gun hand and grabbed him by the wrist. Sebastian stepped in from behind and wrapped his good arm around her throat. Although he was operating with one arm in a sling, his strength was still formidable, and she began to black out for lack of air. Austin suddenly straightened up. Holding the bottle by the neck, he brought it down on Sebastian's head. The bottle broke in a shower of glass and wine. Sebastian released Skye, who fell to the floor, then stood for a few seconds, an expression of wonder in his eyes, and toppled like a fallen redwood tree. Emil stepped aside to avoid Sebastian's crashing body, and the ugly muzzle of the gun swung toward Austin. Austin threw a body block and slammed Emil into the recess. He groped for Emil's gun hand, but Fauchard got off a shot. The shot went wild and the bullet hit the wall inches from Austin's face. Stone fragments peppered Austin's cheek and he was blinded temporarily by the close muzzle flash. He tripped over the bricks and went down onto his knees. Fauchard danced out of the way.
"Too bad you won't have the lingering death I planned for you," he heard Fauchard say. "Since you're on your knees, why don't you try begging for your life?"
"I don't think so," Austin said. His fingers curled around a narrow wooden shaft. He scooped up the crossbow bolt and brought the point down on Emil's foot. The sharp point easily passed through the gold slipper. Emil let out a mighty scream that echoed throughout the vault, and he dropped the gun. By then, Austin was back on his feet. He picked out a point on Emil's jaw and put all his weight and power behind a hard right cross that almost separated Fauchard's head from its shoulders. The gun dropped to the floor and Emil crumpled in a heap next to his companion. Austin helped Skye up. She had her hand to her bruised throat and was having trouble catching her breath. He made sure she could breathe, then he bent over the dough-faced man. "Looks like Sebastian let the wine go to his head."
"Emil said the wine was drugged. How?"
"I let it dribble down my chin. Wine that old probably tastes like vinegar." Austin grabbed Emil by the ankles and pulled him into the recess. Then he cuffed one end of the manacles to Fauchard's wrist and the other to a wall ring. As he took his jester's cap off and pulled it down over Fauchard's ears, he said, For the love of God, Montresor. Austin removed the torch from its sconce and led the way along the tunnel. Despite his drunken act, he had tried to memorize every foot of the route they had followed. Before long, they were back in the dungeons, looking down on Cavendish's body. The rats had scurried off at their approach. The Englishman's plump face was frozen in a rictus of horror. Austin placed his fingers against Cavendish's neck, but he felt no pulse. He's dead.
I don't understand, Skye said. There's no blood.
Austin ran his thumb along the edge of the blade, which was touching the feathers on Cavendish's chest. Fauchard was telling the truth for a change. The blade is made of wood. Emil failed to let Cavendish in on his joke. I think our friend here was scared to death. Come on, there's nothing we can do for him. They continued along the passageway to a steep, narrow, winding staircase. The atmosphere in the tunnel became less musty as they climbed, and soon fresh air was blowing in their faces. They came to a door that opened into the courtyard and followed the laughter around to the front of the chateau, where the guests were being ushered under the open portcullis. Walking slowly and weaving as if they were intoxicated, Austin and Skye caught up with the others. They melded into the crowd, passed through the gate, then walked across the arched stone bridge. Cars were lining up in the circular driveway to pick up the guests, who were effusively bidding each other good night. Soon all the guests had departed, and only Austin and Skye were left. One more car was coming around. It was Darnay's Rolls-Royce. Austin stepped to the rear and opened the door for Skye. He heard someone shout in French and turned to see Marcel running across the bridge. A servant who had been standing nearby heard Marcel's command and stepped in between Austin and the car. The guard was reaching under his tuxedo jacket when Austin demolished him with a short right to the midsection, then yelled at Skye to get in the back seat. He ran around to the other side of the car, yanked the door open, pulled the driver out, dispatched him with an elbow to the jaw, and slid in behind the steering wheel. He snapped the car into gear and stomped the accelerator. The Rolls took off, its tires kicking up a shower of gravel, and skidded around the fountain. Austin saw movement off to his left. Someone was running at the car. He jerked the wheel in the opposite direction. Another guard stepped into the glare of the headlights. He had a gun clutched in both hands. Austin ducked behind the dashboard and nailed the gas pedal. The man bounced over the hood and into the windshield before rolling off. But the windshield was a network of spiderweb cracks from the impact with the man's body. Then the window on the passenger's side disintegrated. Austin saw muzzle flashes ahead and heard a sound like someone whacking a jackhammer against the chrome grill. He yanked the wheel over, felt the impact of another body, and jerked the wheel in the opposite direction. A light burned into his face and made it impossible to see through the damaged windshield. Austin hit the gas again, thinking he was headed for the exit drive, but his sense of direction had been thrown off. The Rolls left the ground at the edge of the moat, soared through the air, and splashed down in the water. The airbag had activated, and as he fought to push it aside, he could feel the water pouring through the window onto his legs. Bullets peppered the roof of the sinking car, but the water dampened their effectiveness. Austin scrunched behind the dashboard and filled his lungs with air. A second later, the car went under completely.